For great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. Welcome to the Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome to the Dirk Pohlman Show. And my guest today from Bath in England is Robin Monotti, sort of a colleague. You're a documentary filmmaker also, I understand. Do you hear me?
Yeah, hi, Dirk. The last project that I've been working on that I'm going to be talking about here at the Better Way Conference is actually a feature film. So it's more narrative-based than documentary-based. And the reason for that would be that I'd like to see if we can get a little bit more to, let's say, shall we call it the other side? Let's say people who haven't really decided to either engage with our understanding and are sticking to another understanding of what's going on. And I'm sort of hopeful that when you've got the power of storytelling, it potentially could do that. Whereas sometimes in the documentary format can be very informative, but some people may choose not to watch it because they don't want that information. So sometimes I think you need to to use their own analogies and their own terminology, you almost need to sort of encode it in some kind of lipid storytelling, if you know what I mean, so that they don't really realize that they are looking at a story about what's going on in the world. They think they're looking at something else. And then this may act at a subconscious level. And I think that is the power of narrative over storytelling when it comes to crossing bridges. The problem is that there is an interest to not let people hear these stories, if you know what I mean.
I know very well what you mean, and what you just said is at the same time a very wise and a very scientific opinion on this, or take on this, because I think you mentioned, I wanted to get into this later in the discussion, but we can start there, because it's really, I think, one of the core points that what we are doing is communicating in a bubble. And I know very, very well what you mean when you talk about documentaries. The problem is also with texts that you preach to the converted, as the English say. It's not that you reach people. This is what I try to do, and I urge. We have a magazine where we urge the readers in Germany to give it to people who might be doubtful, who don't know, and who could be reached. I think it's quite useless to speak to people who have a fixed opinion, and they're in a topic like this, there are not so many who are still changeable. But that is a very, you're in a way, this soft-spoken way is, I think, the most accessible to the other side of the it's like in World War One, it's a grave system and it's a trench system that we're in right now. So I'm very interested in your approach there. So what is basically, I have several questions on the conference right now, but if you can go a little bit into that, what is your storyline and how do you want to do that?
Okay, well, what happened was that it was all the way back in 2017, I received a script that actually I had looked at before, maybe 5 years before, but it changed in that time. And when I first saw it many years ago, it didn't really work for me. Then I received it again and I read it and it really spoke to me. And at the same time, there was a covering letter by the American director, Terrence Malick, thanking us in advance, the reader in advance, for supporting this potential project at a production level. So in the film is called The Book of Vision. It was released, it opened the Critics Week of the Venice Film Festival in September 2020, which was the first physical festival after the first time that they closed all film festivals down and made them online. And then this year, it was released in the UK and Ireland in 2023, and it was released in Italy in 2021. So it's now available on demand in Italy, Ireland, UK, and Russia, but not that many more countries. As I mentioned, executive producer Terrence Malick, and it's starring Charles Dance. It's a journey into the doctor-patient relationship, taking us back to Prussia in the 1700s, and using a case study of a doctor that operated at a transition between what we may call an animistic and a holistic tradition of healing and the doctor-patient relationship to a more contemporary post-Enlightenment, let's say sort of industrial revolution, philosophically oriented view of the body, which we still have now. So we started this before the crisis of 2020 and 2021. But the message, so in that way, I think it's useful because it doesn't directly talk about that. But the message is really about that, because the problem has been with us for a very long time. And if you ask that question, and I relate to what you said very much, and that's kind of the feeling I have about the preaching to the converted issue. Now, the question is, what made if we are the converted, what made us different from the other people who decided to believe? Because, governments always lie. Supranational bodies lie. People were not really ready, perhaps, to accept that doctors lie too. But the lie is bigger than the individual doctor. The lie is the entire view of how the body heals. And that what I call the lie now, is a cultural construct that sees the body as individual mechanical parts. And if there is a symptom that's related to an individual mechanical part, you fix that with an object. And that's that. Whereas in what the film tries to show, it takes you back into the actual issue of the relationship between the patient and the doctor in history, and how much that has changed. And in some ways, it's open enough for people to draw their own conclusions. It's not highly moralistic, but what I draw from it, which may be different from other people, is that the relationship is fundamental. And that the healing comes through relationship, not through objects. And this is something that I have stories of people who were very divided within their own families about their interpretation of the last 3 years. And they sat together to watch this film. And in the end, both of the sides of the divide decided they really liked it. And they sort of felt very empathic with each other and with the message of the film, because it was this indirect way of doing it through narrative, through storytelling. And in some ways, it's not immediate, because the delivery of information, and I think this is where we have a crossover with how we talk about things and how we are prepared to receive knowledge and how we see healing and how we see the body. The direct delivery of information as facts is one way to get only to one side of the mind. Then there is another way, which comes through poetic representation and storytelling and mood and atmosphere. And that way of storytelling does not necessarily act instantly. It may need some time to be absorbed. And that's what we're hoping that the film can do, that over even not in the immediate viewing, maybe just viewing it as a film, but over time, something in it may change the view of the doctor relationship, so that when someone enters, let's say, a doctor's surgery and sees that they are treated in a particular way, a side of them clicks and says, is this really about healing? Because I think that's what divides us from the people who went along with the narrative, is I think that we, or in my case, I mean, I was very sensitive to it because I had been working on this film for a few years already, that there was an instant recognition that what was talked about, the narrative that we were offered, could not possibly lead to healing. And that's not what medicine is or should be, although it has become that. And so a skepticism of the entire direction of the philosophy of medicine is what what I brought into it and what made me become highly skeptical from the first instructions that were given from above, which were common sort of commands, do this or do that. Now, that is not the relationship that is healthy. You know, in any relationship, mm-hmm. to be told what to do is not the healthy way. It should be on the same level. It should be non-hierarchical. It should be empathic, and it should be talking and listening and ready to receive critiques rather than censorship.
Very well. I need, this is also like in medicine, the mechanistic view. We'll have advertisements now for 2 minutes. I get back to you. And I was really listening. My ears are a little bit glowing. So we have to get back to that. And after that, very interesting. I didn't assume that it would take this direction, but we continue in 2 minutes.
You should hear what Joe Hoft is talking about.
This study that was released by the Cleveland Clinic, which is a massive hospital company in the U.S., number of hospitals, maybe the second largest in the world. This entity did a study on COVID, and the results just came out. I saw this tweet. It was released actually yesterday, talking about the results of this study on the COVID vaccines. And listen to this. It found that the higher the number of vaccines previously received, the higher the risk of contracting COVID. I'll repeat, the higher the number of times that you took the vaccine, the higher your risk of contracting COVID. So these people that continue to take these vaccines over and over put themselves at greater risk each time they did of catching COVID. This is a nightmare. And we knew it. We've known it for a long time.
Joe Hoft on TNT Radio.
Reflective Spaces Ministry is a nonprofit, trauma-focused healing ministry ranch in Florida. We provide reflective spaces for transformational healing and total restoration in a faith-filled environment for survivors of human trafficking, sexual and domestic violence, and childhood adversity to thrive. Our mission is to empower survivors to start their own transformative journey as they find peace, calm, and serenity on the grounds of our supportive, tranquil ranch. Whether it's from a tree swing to sitting on a bench quietly thinking, Reflective Spaces Ministry can help recapture the carefree life every child should enjoy without the residue of shame, guilt, fear, self-loathing, and regret. Start your healing journey today. Visit ReflectiveSpacesMinistry.com to find out how you can help and get involved. A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
Dirk Pohlman. On today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Yeah, my guest is Robin Monotti, and it was very interesting for me to listen. I have to say, I come from half of my family side, from my wife, they're all medical doctors. And this issue that you just brought up, we discussed a lot of times during family meetings. And one of the, you can see immediately what you're describing, because the doctors in our world have laboratory white coats. And that shows the distance that they have to the object of their science. That is not being as close as possible, not what you describe, being in a communicative possibility, but rather with a white coat to show that there's an object and you're treated scientifically without feeling really as close to truth as possible. And truth, what they consider is not connected to emotions or to intuitive methods. And it's also that in a way that we pay doctors, we go to doctors and pay them when we're sick, whereas it would be more interesting to have it the Chinese style where you pay as long as you're healthy and the purpose is to keep you healthy. So, and that also in a third part reminds me of the way of communication, which was in the COVID situation became like warfare and became very totalitarian from the state side. This is what brought me in the beginning. For me, it was a scientific topic, but I disliked very soon how everything constitutional was not constitutional, which means don't touch it, but became something like a fair weather story. If it starts to rain, it's not valid anymore. So, that what I'm still a little bit puzzled. I know that you are an architect and quite famous in Great Britain. So what brought you to filmmaking with us? I understand, but it's not easy to make that transgression. How did it work?
Here at the Better Way conference this morning, there's a talk on AI and transhumanism, and we had a number of speakers, including Matthias Desmet, who wrote The Psychology of Totalitarianism, and his message, apart from the explanation of what happened, is about what we need. And he says we need truth tellers. And it's difficult to know what the truth is in an abstract sense, but that we have an intuition of what truth telling is, meaning that the moment that you think you have caught the truth, it's time to move on and it's time to find it elsewhere and to speak another truth. And I think that not at a conscious level, but I think that a lot of things, I was dissatisfied with the direction, general direction, of a lot of different things. And it got to a stage where it became difficult to just operate within one aspect of culture, which is architecture and design, for me, and not to communicate in perhaps a more direct way through other ones. And I didn't necessarily know exactly why. And one element, there's supposedly Michel Foucault in the Courage of Truth. He mentioned four different ways of truth telling, and one of them is called prophecy. It's where you foresee something happening. Now you have no proof because it will happen in the future, but you foresee. And I think that in the script that I read and in the feelings that I got, there was a sort of prophetic feeling, because it was feeling-based, that it was something important that I needed to get involved in. And objectively speaking, why get involved in a doctor-patient relationship? There's not really many films about it that explore it. There was very limited interest at the time. People don't really want to be reminded of doctors and illness through entertainment. And it only became evident later, I think, why we were doing it. So things happen and you have senses that something is wrong. And I think we had a sense that something was wrong. And I think we all had it when we encountered the script, and the people who read it, they had a sense that something was wrong. So we met on that level. And in the element of going to see a doctor today, as you said, they have a white robe. Usually it's a very clinical room, which is stripped of any human symbol. Then there are transactions over a number of different objects. So there is a computer, perhaps, and maybe an X-ray, maybe some kind of MRI scan, maybe some blood test. So there's a vial. Then there is a notepad. Then there's scribbles, and then there is a transaction when you are given a medicine or a pharmaceutical. Now, these are all objects. But where is the relationship gone? Now, in all relationships, there are two sides of it. So that's where I think that we need to look at what our side has also accepted about this relationship. Now, if we went to the doctor and we just had a talk and we talked about our feelings, our issues in life, in the world, and they were seen as a doctor and they didn't give us a pharmaceutical at the end of it, would we feel that we got what we wanted? A lot of people probably would feel that they need to be given some prescription for some pharmaceutical today. So the relationship, people are going along with it on both sides, but shouldn't it instead be that it maybe it's 50-50. Sometimes you go in and you have a chat and maybe you say, come back and talk to me about this in a few days. But don't take anything. Don't do anything. Just think about this, or just walk more, or just. So we are participating in a relationship which is based on objects and objectification. And we are starting to collect, you know, we collect a lot of these things. So we collect medicines in medicine cabinets, we collect prescriptions, we sort of, we collect a series of objects which starts to symbolize this whole flawed understanding of health. Now, if we go back to one view that Freud had about the collector, the psychology of the collector as such, what he said is that the collector replaced the relationship with other people, so the human bonds with other people, with bonds with objects. So the collector collects all of these objects as a replacement for the missing human bonds. Now, this is what we've done in the field of medicine. So we are creating an object-based relationship based on pharmaceuticals. But what are they replacing? They're replacing the relationship with the doctor, which is now limited to a very short period of time under very clinical circumstances and deeply hierarchical ones. And this is not what it was. And we introduce this in the film, which is done in also in non-clinical way, quite atmospheric photography by a German director of photography called Jörg Widmer, who is a master of his art. The film also opened, apart from the Critics Week in Venice, it opened Warsaw Film Festival, and there were conversations there about a German distribution, which hasn't happened yet. That's sort of the dilemma and the problem when you try and tell a story and you make it a soft approach, is that in a way the entire field is getting more and more pushed into sort of high action, formulaic cinema, where it's high tempo, where it's a bit of a roller coaster. So you go in and you've got a roller coaster of all different things, maybe superheroes. And that doesn't lend itself for, you know, a philosophical critique of you know, the history of medicine and doctor-patient relationship in narrative form, as a poetic journey. So it's not the type of filmmaking that, you know, maybe someone who's even born, like, I don't know, 15 years ago has even really possibly even witnessed. If you've got a bit of a longer history of cinema, you would. So the issue is that, and now we talked about AI. We're talking about AI this morning. In the last Cannes Film Festival, there's a lot of conferences about AI and what AI can do in film. What AI can help with script writing. It can help with VFX. Can help with a lot of different things. But in a way, AI will probably end up doing more formulaic blockbuster superhero films because those formulas are quite, they don't need a whole new critique of anything to work, so they can work. So the issue we have is that the entire field seems to be almost being prepared to be taken over in some ways by a form of sort of maybe human-led AI, which then can be controlled remotely by perhaps tech giants who already control what we see. So the fact that this film was shot from 2017 onwards means that we could shoot it, we could get the funding, we didn't have a machine against us because most of the people in that machine didn't really know what was planned for us in 2019. Now it could be difficult to make it, so we've made it, but there is a degree of control to one level on the distribution of specific countries, you know, Germany being one, but that control in a way has we've overcome it in England and Ireland because we've got, you know, the film is on Apple, Amazon, Google, Sky, Rakuten. So, you know, the tech giants are hosting the film. They wouldn't host a documentary on a similar subject, I think, right now, possibly. But it's not being promoted. And so that's why I like to talk about it. And that's why I thank you also for allowing me to talk about it. So if anyone is in these countries, they can have a go at watching it. But you know, beyond this one, I think that we do need to be careful to not let our art forms, which tell stories in a particular way, to be co-opted by the same people, the same machine we're trying to fight. Because once they control, they do control most of the media, but once they control all of our art forms, yes, they do control the distribution, once they control all of that, it will be very difficult to tell even indirect stories. Now we can still do it. Now we have done it, and I hope it will have, you know, a long life, and I hope that it will be able to be shown also in the countries that unfortunately we haven't managed to get distribution in, for probably predictable reasons, that the message behind it, if there's not, you know, if anyone sees a message behind it, it contradicts the direction that we are being told that we should go in, you know, transhumanist and all of that. It kind of contradicts it, but not in a moralistic way, because we do use technology. We show the positive sides of technology as well in the film, but ultimately it's the human heart and that is the important thing.
I can relate to that very well. I think On the Horizon is a dividing line, which is not really left right in the old terms of politicians, but rather the human intuition and transcendental capabilities versus the chess computer, I would call that, something like that. I just came up with that word. It's not a long thought before that, but you described something that is AI is a major issue that we're facing, and of course this computing way of thinking, their computers might be better than us, but they will not be able to come up with these kind of stories. They will can come up with lots of stories, with journalistic content, with documentary content, for example, as well. For example, for doctors and for lawyers, it will be a major thing. But this is really the question. It's a question about the human condition, about the human nature. I would very much like to get back to you, Robin Monotti. My time is over now with you, but this topic is of so important, and I tried to get you in contact with some people in Germany who might be helpful. At least I could try that. But to talk about that, so I will contact you again to have another hour with you about these topics and to go on, because I think it's of utmost importance. Yeah, it is really. Great. And yeah, so thank you very much, and
thank you.
Hope to hear from you soon again. Yeah,
great. Thank you. Speak to you soon.
Bye. And I have a second guest for the next half hour, who is a renowned scientist, Dr. Jessica Rose. And if I'm going to read all her academic titles, we have a lot of time to spend. It's biochemistry, molecular biology, where she has a PhD, computational biology. She has a master in medicine, immunology, and she also has a bachelor in applied mathematics. So this is really, if it would be in medals, you would look like the dictator of a banana republic, probably. So are you in now, Dr. Jessica Rose? Do you have you on the microphone on the show?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Though that's really, I was in a way, I thought, when did you do all this? I mean, it is, but I'd like to get into something. We just had a very good article from a colleague of mine, a journalist who's also as me, as background in philosophy, and he's writing very good articles, and he reminded us of the numbers that we have from Germany from the last 3 years. And he says it looks at the numbers of death, and the numbers of death in 2000 are on average, and if you go into 2020, if you look into 2021, it's rising. So when there were the vaccination, it's astonishingly, we have about 10% higher average death rates, and it doesn't go down in 2022 when everybody had been boosted, and some people I know 3-4 times. So this is, and then he always puts, like in the speech about Brutus, where he says, but Brutus is an honorable man. He always asks, can somebody come up with an idea what happened? So, and this is one of your specialities, these kind of things. So is this only in Germany, or is it worldwide? I mean, it should be a topic at the conference right now. Can you say something about that?
Is there a question in there? I was overwhelmed by the amount of information you just gave.
Okay, the question is, we have obviously a rise in the number of deaths in 21 and in 22. And is this a worldwide trend that you know? Is it a trend in the United States as well? Or is it something specific
for
Germany?
Yeah, no, we're seeing this all over the world. Excess mortality is, you know, it's a clear indicator. It's probably one of the best ways to determine whether or not the injections are, you know, whether these deaths are causally related. So one of the things that is strange, though, and you probably noticed this too, is that there's never any mention of even the possibility, even though nobody knows why the all-cause mortality rates are higher all across the world. Nobody's saying why. Nobody's suggesting that it might be something that happened in 2021, even though it's in perfect correspondence with something that happened in 2021. So, I mean, if we were doing logic, rationality, if there was science, if there was debate, if there was anything that we kind of have had before, we would be asking the obvious question, wouldn't we? Is it the shots, the COVID injections, that are causing these excess deaths? And then we would do whatever we needed to do to find out that they are, I mean, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a global phenomenon. We're seeing this in data coming out of just about everywhere that's revealing that data.
Yeah, and you just mentioned that. I witnessed the court case against Professor Bakhti in Germany, who was accused of anti-Semitism.
Yes.
And that was really, yeah, it's, I argued.
It's laughable.
Of course, it's laughable, but it works very well. And I did some interviews last year on the same Better World Conference, and none of the people, I repeat, none of the people that I interviewed were not fired, lost their positions, were taken their doctor's titles away. They all had severe consequences for speaking out. And I think this is what you just mentioned is exactly the case, that there is an atmosphere of fear surrounding this topic, which has been carefully crafted. That if you touch it, it's like also what happened to Professor Bakhti, who is a foremost expert in immunology. I mean, he was a C4 professor in Mainz, and he was he lectured in the room where it was not Leibniz, the other guy who was from Great Britain, the foremost, you know, gravity. The name doesn't jump to my mind right now. In the Royal Society, he was lecturing in the same room, like, why don't I get the name? Okay. So he's okay. He is an expert. He's one of the foremost experts. So they attacked him on a different field, and that was anti-Semitism. And he said some things which, and that has made a topic in Germany where if you would make an interview with me in 10 minutes, I would say something that somebody could twist, bend, and interpret in a way that would to call me an anti-Semite too. It's like having a tango in a minefield. Sooner or later, it will be a big explosion and a cloud of blood that would surround you. So this is something which I have never encountered before, and you mentioned that. And there's another case which I've never encountered. That was the publication in Nature, where about 20 foremost scientists said it is not from a lab, it is natural, it's some pangolin had some intercourse with a bat or whatever, and that happened from nature. And then it turns out that this came under pressure. And that's, of course, that means science doesn't, probably hasn't worked for a long time and didn't, but this is proof that it doesn't work according to its own rules. It's kind of a power play situation now. And Is that what about you? Have you been? Sorry, it's again a long talk, but have you encountered the difficulties that you must have encountered difficulties with the work you do? Are you so independent that you can do it? Are you fearless, or what is the reason that you can do it?
I wouldn't say that I'm fearless, but I don't live in fear. Nobody's fearless, right? It's a part of being human. So if anyone tells you they're not afraid, they're lying. And yeah, I am independent now. The timing was perfect for me. I had just finished my second postdoc in biochemistry. And like 2 months later, they declared the pandemic. So I was poised and ready, having had my life plans diverted, because I was actually planning to become more of a professional surfer than a scientist, but that didn't happen. So
okay.
Yeah, that's a true story.
You are as good in surfing as you are in science.
I'm way better surfer than I am a scientist. There's something. I'm a longboarder, so I'm not like one of the best. Don't get me wrong, but it's one of these things that my being and my heart is very, very strongly attached to. It's more about, like, it feels like a bonding experience with, you know, the water and the movement. If I start talking about surfing, it's the end of the interview, so I better not. But everything's been absconded now. It's true what you're saying.
You mean you're human? You're truly human? You're not only a scientist? But okay, go on. No.
I am so much more than the academic in me. It's why, like, I've never been a professor. I'm not a tenured professor. I've been in academia most of my life. It is what I do. But I'm kind of black sheepy in general, the academic world is no exception. I always stay on the perimeter and I watch from the outside wherever I am. But yeah, it's almost like the algorithms are getting better at functioning to tag anything. I don't even want to use the word related, because it's like nothing has to be related to anything in order to call someone an anti-Semite and get them in a world of like shite right now. It's I shouldn't say that. It's ridiculous what's happening right now. You can call a Jewish person who survived the Holocaust an anti-Semite now and get away with it. I mean, it's absolute. It's lunacy to me. What's happening? It's almost as if we're living in a world now where, if a random person says something extraordinarily offensive and denigrating about you, then it can become truth. It's absurd. I was having a conversation about hit pieces that are being written on a number of us lately yesterday. And my personal take on this, because I do take it very personally, because the first time I stay away from hit pieces written about me, first of all, because it's too energetically draining. But the first one that I read, it was written by a woman, and I was so astounded because I kept seeing my name written down, and I kept coming back to myself and saying, how is this person writing all this weird personal stuff about me when I don't know who she is? I've never had a conversation with her. I've never had an email exchange with her. I don't know who she is. And yet she's saying all of these things about me that are absolutely just made up. There's no other way to say it. And it puts you in a really odd position, because for the people who don't know me, and that's like most people, if they read that for the first time, and if they think that that person is credible, then they're going to believe what they wrote. And it's very important for people to understand what I'm about to say. Just because you're reading something, just because something is printed, it has no relevance on its truthfulness or reality these days. Maybe once upon a time it did, when journalism was still alive. But to find good journalists these days, it's very difficult. And journalism is always going to be controversial. That's why it's great. You know, we want to hear about what people are doing if they're doing something bad and it's affecting us, because we need to tell our neighbors and friends then, and then we need to put an end to it. But that trajectory is just completely off course now, because, I mean, yeah, it's like our systems are abundantly controlled, and it seems like they're mono-controlled.
I have to go to the advertisements again. Let's get back to that, because I think it's this is a very important topic coming from the Bhakti court case. But I also would like to have about 10 minutes about what's going on the Better World Conference in terms of science. But first, advertisements, and let's get back to that.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
We're more than a year away from the Democrat and Republican Party nominating conventions, but already people are starting to express concerns over what role AI might play in the election. Darrell West, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's Center for Technology Innovation, says it's going to be very difficult for voters to distinguish the real from the fake, and you can just imagine how either Trump supporters or Biden supporters could use this technology to make the opponent look bad. There could be things that drop right before the election that nobody has a chance to take down. Gee, you think? Let's just take a little lesson from our military, who decided to see what would happen if you tasked AI with conducting drone strikes against surface-to-air missile batteries. There was a human override failsafe that would instruct the drones not to engage a target, but the AI decided that because it identified a SAM battery, it should destroy the SAM battery, and therefore the human was the problem. Thankfully, the drones weren't armed because the drones tried to take out the human that was sending it an override signal. Recognizing their quote-unquote programming error, they told the drones not to attack the human. So what did the drones do instead? They attacked the radio towers that were connecting the human to the drone. Sure, this technology can't get out of hand and cause any problems. No, not at all. AI needs to be regulated, and regulated fast. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
This is your captain. We are going to be experiencing some slight turbulence. Please fasten your... Oh, hold on. Just got a video of my cat.
Imagine the pilot of an airplane was as confident as you are texting and driving. Seems kind of crazy when you put it like that.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Dirk Pohlman on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is Dirk Pohlman, and my guest is Dr. You can multiply as often as you want, Jessica Rose. And we have been discussing about the warfare of journalism, which is what it turned into. And I think this is a very valid statement that you gave, that is a good example of what a good journalist could do is an interview that I just reread from 1922. That was Osip Mandelstam, a Russian poet, so not really a journalist, but he worked as a journalist, and he interviewed Ho Chi Minh in Moscow in 1922, who was at that time not a famous person. He was just the only guy from this area who had been in Moscow at a conference. And the point is that Osip Mandelstam succeeded in giving you on two pages a valid depiction of the essence of that personality, whereas what you described is what is done nowadays is to find some minute detail and write about it and turn it into the essence of the person they write about and give a false impression in terms of what I would call information warfare. It's not looking for fairness. It's not looking for to be a person that understands the other side, that is willing to understand. I often tell people when they ask me now, should I do the interview, I say, no, you shouldn't, because it's like you're dealing with a poisonous snake and the snake asks you to kiss it. But you know what will happen when you do it. So stay away from the snake and try to find out what kind of things he wrote or filmed before. And this is what you were describing. This is all over. And in the COVID instance, it was everybody who had a dissenting view was declared a dangerous idiot, somebody who should be in jail, but we're not yet there that we can do it. So you have been attacked too. Did you lose some of your titles, or what happened to you?
If you have no, you can't take away my titles. I earned those. I can't say that I've lost more than I've gained, and I really mean that. For example, Norman Fenton just walked by me, and he's become one of my buddies. The number of amazing people that I've met with incredible backgrounds and careers, I never would have met them if this hadn't happened. So even if I have lost some things, I've gained other things. The personal attacks do bother me, but like I said, I try not to give that energy, for lack of a better way of saying it, because that's their point. They function to distract. They're not only trying to distract the masses with a number of BS stories, they're trying to create infighting and distract the people who are trying to fight back and reveal the fact that they're a bunch of liars, for lack of a better way of saying it. And by they, I mean, you know, the people propagating the one-track mind messages, like there's only one way out of a solution, blah, 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 if you know what I mean. I had something to tell you about what's going on at the Better Way conference, and now I can't remember what it was. It was an example from one of the talks that was given, but maybe you can jog my memory with a new question.
Yeah, maybe we try. My point would really be, because I'm not there, and what impressed you the most in terms of information? When I was last year in Vienna, Arne Burkhardt, I mean, that was a horror show. He died. He died yesterday, and
I know.
We just heard about it. That's a pity, because in a way also we need these retired people who can be brave without fearing for their livelihood, and that is very strange. That's like the generals who become fighters against the nuclear weapons after they retire. There are quite a lot of them. Even the chief of the Strategic Air Command, General Lee Butler. Newton, now with Butler comes, Isaac Newton was the guy which was a predecessor of Bhakti in that room. So sorry for about that. So so what impressed you most, what you heard during the conference now, in terms of all your knowledge and statistics and medicine?
Well, it's unfortunate, but I haven't heard a lot of the talks because I've actually been dedicating my time to talking myself for interviews. So, but that's important too, right?
Okay.
So, I mean, of course, there are fantastic speakers, it sounds bad to say, but the story hasn't changed data-wise. So there's, it's not as if there's a lot of new information that I haven't heard yet. I try and stay very up to date, but as far as, say, pharmacovigilance data goes, like what I'm looking at, not all-cause mortality, there is something new in VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System data, but the trends are exactly the same. And it's like, if you've heard me say anything about what's going on in VAERS, it's the same now. It's still trending up. Every week there are more reports being filed. However, as of 2 weeks ago, the number of reports being removed without explanation has also increased. So we know, and by we I mean the community of people looking at the VAERS data, we know that this has been a thing the whole time. I even published a paper on this. I calculated how many deaths were being removed, for example, each week, how many total reports were being removed each week, but it's accelerated. That's my point. So in terms of what like Pierre and Paul, et cetera, are saying, you know, it's the story remains the same. The most important thing I think people should be talking about right now, well, there are two things. The contamination in the shots that was discovered by Kevin McKernan, and these IHR amendments that the WHO are going to try to enforce on us to remove national and personal sovereignty forever. This is like, if we don't stop that, you know, I don't want to continue the sentence.
What do you think, because I interviewed Bhakti, and he obviously feels that he has to warn the world that the mRNA vaccinations will be a box of Pandora opened. Do you have the same opinion? Are you similar to his opinion?
Oh, yeah. I like Sukrit talks very plainly about immunology 101. So when he speaks, I'm also an immunologist. I don't have as long or distinguished a career, of course, but I can back up everything he says with my own background and say, yeah, I agree with what he's saying. Now, it's the predictability thing that we don't have from any point of view. What we know from raw data and from listening to people's accounts, personal accounts, is that something is wrong with these shots in terms of causing enormous numbers and an enormous range of side effects that is without limit. We're talking about neurological conditions, blindness, death, cardiovascular, it doesn't matter how old you are. I mean, it's affecting kids. And the question is, why are the people who are suffering the most suffering the most? Because this ain't only about cofactors or, you know, counterindications. Or maybe it is. We have to find out what. But having said that, even though it looks to me so far that it's only a subpopulation of people who got injected who are suffering, we don't know if there are going to be delayed effects. And I think that's what Sukrit's main worry and concern is that, you know, I've heard people use the expression ticking time bomb. I don't like that because I think it does that thing to people, the fear thing, which I think is the reason why we're in the position we're in is because of all the fear mongering. So I prefer not to use that language, but we just don't know. And this is another annoying thing about what's been happening on the subject of censorship and, you know, silencing people who are speaking real science and data. We don't get a chance to debate and we don't get a chance to answer the necessary questions that we need to in order to find quicker and better solutions. Because, like I said earlier today to someone, if we are allowed to do that, we as a team of humans could solve this problem in a week. I mean, the problem of the people who are suffering. That's what I think.
Okay.
Hello.
I hear you. I'm listening. I don't have to talk all the time. It's very interesting. So what I always wonder, when it started, for example, we were told from the top scientists in Germany, Max Planck Institutes, they said it will not go into the human DNA. It will not be in the inheritor stream, so to speak. And now we know this was wrong. And then I always ask myself, is it only, I don't know if you have an answer to that, but is it only money in terms that you put the production into the human body? You don't have the production and you're not legally bound anymore. They could just do it and they signed the contracts. It's a free hand that they got. Is it that, or is it even something more? I talked with Sukrit Bhakti, and he doesn't really talk about it, but he assumes that there is more to it. And what is your take on that? We only have about 1 minute left, so sorry for that short answer.
Darn. I think that there might be something more, and my logical brain, which is interesting because it is my rational logical brain, tells me that it cannot be only about money, because these people, whoever they are are driven by some deviant form of passion. I don't really think the word passion is the best word to use, but they are motivated. And they do seem to be one track minded into absolutely getting everybody who is a human being injected with their products, which makes no sense from an epidemiological, an immunological, or a vaccinological point of view. So, yeah, there might be something else going on.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jessica Rose, for the interview. And one of the stations that you can at least hear about this is TNT. Don't forget it. It's not CNN. Bye.